From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Nearly 100,000 American troops have now left Iraq under my presidency. Iraqis have taken full responsibility for their security, and we will continue to support Iraq as it forms an inclusive government, and we will bring all of our troops home.
President Obama says he's ending the war in Iraq, though Defense Secretary Gates says withdrawal could take longer than planned. We'll look at Iraq now and how the war affected the Middle East with independent journalist Nir Rosen, his new book, Aftermath, Following the Bloodshed of America's Wars in the Muslim World. Then War Torn, a new film chronicles post-traumatic stress disorder and the lingering effects of war on soldiers from the Civil War until today.
Horrible nightmares from that, sometimes crying and scrubbing my hands, trying to get blood that's not there off.
I don't want to talk. I don't want to eat. I don't want to sleep. I don't want to move.
We'll be joined by the filmmakers, John Alpert and Matt O'Neill, and the parents of two soldiers who committed suicide after coming home from Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama's arrived in South Korea for the G20 Leaders Summit after a brief stop in Indonesia, in what was billed as an update to his 2009 Cairo speech on U.S. relations with Muslims worldwide. Obama addressed a large audience at the University of Indonesia in Jakarta.
Innocent civilians in America, in Indonesia, and across the world are still targeted by violent extremism. I've made it clear that America is not and never will be at war with Islam. Instead, all of us must work together to defeat al-Qaeda and its affiliates, who have no claim to be leaders of any religion, certainly not a great world religion like Islam. But those who want to build must not cede ground to terrorists who seek to destroy. And this is not a task for America alone.
During his remarks, President Obama also discussed the withdrawal of tens of thousands of U.S. troops from Iraq.
And meanwhile, we've made progress on one of our core commitments, our effort to end the war in Iraq. Nearly 100,000 American troops have now left Iraq under my presidency. Iraqis have taken full responsibility for their security. And we will continue to support Iraq as it forms an inclusive government, and we will bring all of our troops home.
As Obama spoke of an Iraq pullout, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said the U.S. could, in fact, keep its troops there beyond a 2011 deadline for withdrawal. Gates made the comments during a visit to Malaysia.
We are open to discussing it. And I think it really depends as much as anything on in terms of timing, it's really up to the Iraqis. I think it will take them a little time once they get a government, once they select a president, prime minister, and speaker of the Council of Representatives to make the ministerial appointments and form the government. So we will just we'll stand by, and we're ready to have that discussion if and when they want to raise it with us.
Health officials in Haiti have confirmed the deadly cholera outbreak has reached the capital of Port-au-Prince. Over 70 people are being treated for the disease there, and doctors in camps for earthquake survivors have reported seeing hundreds of people with symptoms. On Tuesday, the Haitian government said the disease now threatens the entire country. John Andrus of the Pan American Health Organization said the outbreak will be long-term.
What we know about Haiti's infrastructure, it's likely that this is not a short-term intervention. We have to think about the long-term and plan for the long-term for a few years in front of us. So it's an island, and island epidemiology enters the picture, but it has a foothold. The bacteria has a foothold in the river system and in other sources of water, and it will remain, and it will be a challenge to control future spread.
The Justice Department has announced no one will be charged for the destruction of video showing the interrogation of two foreign prisoners. The tapes were destroyed amidst worries they would do political damage if ever publicly revealed. According to The Washington Post, charges could still be filed related to obstruction of justice or misleading investigators during the probe. The prosecutor heading the case, John Durham, is conducting a separate investigation into whether CIA interrogators and contractors should be charged for the Bush-era torture and abuse of foreign prisoners. The co-chair of the White House panel investigating the Gulf Coast oil spill is calling for safety overhauls at the three main companies involved. On Tuesday, William Riley cited what he called, quote, a culture of complacency at BP, Halliburton, and Transocean, and said each require, quote, top-to-bottom reform. The Environmental Protection Agency, meanwhile, has subpoenaed Halliburton to disclose the chemicals used in its gas drilling practice known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. The EPA says Halliburton is the lone of nine companies to ignore a request for information on the chemicals issued earlier this year. The EPA is carrying out a national study on how fracking is affecting the nation's water supplies. New figures show nearly 59 million Americans went without health insurance for at least part of this year. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, many lacked insurance despite having conditions or diseases that require treatment. The number marks an increase of at least 4 million people from the same period in 2008. A prominent lesbian activist has filed another federal lawsuit against the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, which bars federal recognition of same-sex couples. Edith Windsor of New York says she was forced to pay over $350,000 in estate taxes because her marriage to Thea Speier wasn't recognized under federal law. Speier died in 2009. The two married in Canada in 2007, after 41 years as a couple. The suit says the gay marriage ban effectively imposes a new tax on gay and lesbian couples. U.S. peace activists have launched a guerrilla campaign to disrupt sales of former President George W. Bush's new memoir, Decision Points. The blog Waging Nonviolence has called on supporters to move copies of the book into the crime section of stores where it's sold, as British activists did with former Prime Minister Tony Blair's book earlier this year. On Tuesday, a group of demonstrators rallied at a Dallas bookstore as Bush signed copies inside. The protesters called for Bush's arrest for authorizing torture and the war in Iraq. The Obama administration has mildly criticized Israel's latest plans to build over 1,000 settlement homes in occupied East Jerusalem. During his visit to Indonesia, President Obama said Israel's settlement expansion is, quote, never helpful. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat called on the U.S. to demand an Israeli withdrawal to its recognized 1967 borders.
And this is why we call upon the United States and the European Union, if they want to preserve the two-state solution and the peace process, to respond to such Israeli unilateralism by declaring the recognition of the state of Palestine on the 67 lines with East Jerusalem as its capital.
In Peru, the American activist Lori Berenson has spoken out following her release this week on parole. Lori Berenson was sent back to prison in August, just 3 months after her release from nearly 15 years behind bars. She was convicted in 1996 by hooded Peruvian military judges of collaborating with the rebel group MRTA.
Obviously, I understand there are a lot of people that despise me, would like to see me dead, probably. It's not easy to deal with that situation, but I understand it. And I have to live with it. And that's why I was in jail, and that's why I had a was sentenced, and that's why this all, you know, I understand that. I would be nice if people didn't see me as the face of terrorism, but I can't change that. So I live with that.
Lori Berenson speaking in Peru. Workers at the Berkeley, California-based Pacifica radio station KPFA are criticizing a decision to cancel the KPFA morning show and lay off the show's entire staff. Pacifica axed the morning show this week, citing the need for budget cuts. The morning show staffers say they're being targeted for criticism of Pacifica's executive board. And San Francisco has become the first U.S. city to ban the high-calorie children's Happy Meal served at the McDonald's fast food chain. On Tuesday, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors gave final approval to a proposal barring restaurants from giving toys with meals containing excessive fat and sugar. Under the rule, restaurants will also have to serve fruits and vegetables alongside any meals with toys. The measure takes effect in December of 2011. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadous.
And welcome, everyone. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said Tuesday that the United States is open to the idea of keeping American troops in Iraq past the 2011 deadline for withdrawal. Speaking in Malaysia, Gates added that the request would have to come from the Iraqi government. He noted that any talks on the issue would have to wait until Iraqi leaders agreed to a power-sharing deal and ended the long stalemate that has followed parliamentary elections in March. Meanwhile, inside Iraq, there's been little respite from the violence in recent weeks. On Monday, bomb attacks on Shia Muslim targets in three Iraqi cities left at least 19 people dead and many more injured. Last week, a deadly siege by gunmen in a Catholic church in Baghdad left 52 dead. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki visited the Our Lady of Salvation Church on Tuesday.
Despite the pain we feel from such a huge attack, we will not be subjected to their will. Yesterday was Karbala, Najaf, and Basra, and so they will continue on with their attacks. Their means are a combination of hatred and political motives to hinder the political process and block the reconstruction of the country.
Here in the United States, former President George W. Bush has defended his decision to attack Iraq in 2003. In his first major interview since leaving office, Bush spoke to NBC's Matt Lauer as part of a promotional campaign around his memoir, Decision Points.
So by the time you gave the order to start military operations in Iraq, did you personally have any doubt, any shred of doubt about that intelligence?
No, I didn't. I really didn't.
Not everybody thought you should go to war, though. There were dissenters.
Of course there were.
Did you filter them out?
I was a dissenting voice. I didn't want to use force.
Your words. No one was more sickened or angry than I was when we didn't find weapons of mass destruction. You still have a sickening feeling.
I do.
When you think about it.
I do.
Was there ever any consideration of apologizing to the American people?
I mean, apologizing would basically say the decision was a wrong decision. And I don't believe it was a wrong decision.
If you knew then what you know now,
that's right,
you would still go to war in Iraq?
First of all, I didn't have that luxury. You just don't have the luxury when you're president. I will say, definitely, the world is better off without Saddam Hussein in power, as are 25 million people who now have a chance to live in freedom.
That was President Bush. Well, for more on Iraq, as well as Afghanistan and U.S. involvement in other parts of the Middle East, we're joined here in New York by independent journalist Nir Rosen. His latest book is called Aftermath, Following the Bloodshed of America's Wars in the Muslim World. Nir Rosen is also a fellow at New York University's Center on Law and Security. Welcome to Democracy Now! Let's start with President Bush's words.
Oh, what's he going to say? This is a man whose legacy is Iraq. He said that 25 million Iraqis are better off. Certainly, the hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqis are not better off. Their families aren't better off. The tens of thousands of Iraqi men who languished in American and subsequently Iraqi gulags are not better off. The children who lost their fathers aren't better off. The millions of Iraqis who lost their homes, hundreds of thousands of refugees in the region are not better off. So there's no mathematical calculation you can make to determine who's better off and who's not.
Well, he said Saddam Hussein is gone.
Saddam Hussein is gone, that's true. The regime we've put in place is certainly more representative, but it's brutal and authoritarian. Torture is routine and systematic. Corruption is also routine and systematic. There are no services to speak of, no real electricity or water. Violence remains very high. So there's nothing to be proud of in this. The Iraqi people deserve much better, and they're the real victims of Bush's war.
And what's happening right now in Iraq? There's been a long stalemate following the parliamentary elections in March. You were in Iraq many times since 2003, and you documented very closely, for example, Muqtada al-Sadr and the Mahdi army. Where does he fit into all of this, and where does the Iraqi government fit into the picture today?
Well, Iraq today and in the future, I think, will look more and more like Mexico or Pakistan, in that you're going to have a strong central regime, a little bit authoritarian, certainly corrupt, brutal security forces, but strong. Nobody can overthrow it. Nobody's threatening to overthrow it. No more real militia activity. And terrible violence, which just becomes normal, much as it is in Mexico or Pakistan. A violence which doesn't threaten the new order, but certainly threatens the lives of many civilians on a regular basis, and people have to adjust to that and live their lives accordingly. Prime Minister Maliki is going to remain. He was always going to remain. There was never any question. When you're in power, why would you give up power? And the Americans have been backing him since at least August. And indeed, he's probably the least worst candidate in that he has at least the support of some countries in the region. Of the majority of the Iraqi people, to some extent. He does have a certain amount of legitimacy. He's credited, rightly or wrongly, with the reduction in violence that began in 2008 when he went after the Shia militias. So the Sadrists are much maligned, but they are the largest, perhaps they're the only grassroots movement in Iraq, and the largest real movement, real party.
Explain who they are.
They are a Shia movement which represents the poor, dispossessed, angry and marginalized Shias of Iraq. This is a class of sort of revolutionary a class, which in the 50s and 60s supported communism, was anti-establishment, and the voice of that anger in the 90s and certainly post-American invasion has been the Sadrists, a religious movement, which is more or less anti-establishment, anti-federalist, was very much anti-occupation, was part of the resistance, but also played a major role as a Shia self-defense militia that got drawn more and more into the civil war and became more and more implicated in brutality, first against Sunnis and even against Shia civilians. They were finally crushed by a combination of Prime Minister Maliki's forces and the American military in 2008. So now they remain a real serious movement, the only one which even talks about improvement of services and social issues. At the same time, they always have that implied threat of the ability to return to their militia activity. They were associated with Iran because they were marginalized. They ended up looking to Iran for support. And certainly some of their units were trained by the Iranians to be better able to blow up American vehicles, have better aim with their mortars. These days, it's no longer an issue anymore because the occupation is sort of mostly a non-issue. But it looks like they're going to be integrated into the government in the new coalition, which has been controversial. I maintain that that's a good thing, that you want them in the system. When they were marginalized, they were pushed to violence and acted as spoilers. But when they're in the establishment, when they're part of the government, it's very difficult to be anti-establishment when you're in the establishment. It's very difficult to try to undermine the system when you have to deal with mundane things like improving sewage services and electricity and things like that. And you don't want this group of people who historically have been marginalized from Iraq to continue to feel marginalized.
You're saying they, but Muqtada al-Sadr, explain his what happened to him.
He was the son of Mohammad Sadiq Sadr, an Ayatollah that was allegedly assassinated in 1999 by Saddam's agents, although nobody really knows who did it. And he didn't have Muqtada, a high level of clerical education, but that wasn't really the point of his popularity. It was more that he was the son of this important family and that he spoke in this sort of common Iraqi accent and expressed the anger of this sort of revolutionary class of Shias. And when he was angry, he was popular. To the extent that he stopped being angry, he would often lose popularity. He was pushed in 2007 to seek exile in Iran, and where he's allegedly studying to be an Ayatollah, which will give him more clerical authority. But he remains the single most popular individual among most Shias, although he's reviled by many Sunnis because they blame the Mahdi army for its sectarianism. Obviously, the Americans have a grudge against him as well because his forces were involved in attacking the American occupation. And it appears that he's biding his time, waiting for the right moment to return to Iraq, where he won't assume a political role, but he'll be a very important symbolic leader of this movement.
And in a moment, we're going to play a clip of President Bush. He also spoke about the surge. This has been talked about as the great success of the American occupation of Iraq is ending the civil war. But I wanted to ask you first about the civil war. This is how you start your book. And part one of your book you call the Lebanonization of Iraq. What do you mean by that term, and how did the civil war really take hold in Iraq?
By Lebanonization of Iraq, I mean that sectarian identity became more and more important and the key to obtaining power. and sectarian groups were pitted against each other, much as we see in Lebanon. Now, in Lebanon, that's more of a formal structure. In Iraq, it was just a sort of became that way. Although the Americans did introduce certain sectarian quotas into the original sort of puppet governing council they established. And this was very disturbing to Iraqis because they had never thought of themselves primarily as Sunni or Shia, and that had never been the overt primary way in which you would attain power. So in the summer of 2003, when the Americans began to institute this kind of official sectarianism and institutionalize it, you had Iraqis warning the Americans are trying to create a civil war. Now, they weren't actually trying to create a civil war. They were just incompetent and stupid about the way they went about the occupation. Now, the civil war did not begin in 2006. There's a narrative which has become accepted that things were going more or less poorly thanks to various incorrect decisions. And then in 2006, this Samarra shrine, a Shia shrine north of Baghdad, was blown up, and suddenly the civil war broke out, and we had nothing to do with it. In fact, the civil war started, you could even say, in 2003, when following the invasion, you had this huge power vacuum, and militias began to form, and scores were being settled. But certainly by the end of 2004, the civil war started in a very intense way. Americans destroyed Fallujah in late 2004. Hundreds of thousands of refugees from Fallujah poured into western Baghdad. They began to displace Shias from western Baghdad, who fled to east Baghdad and began to displace Sunnis. Now, Shias were still quite weak in those days. But beginning in 2005, after the elections of January 2005, the Shia-dominated government began to be much more aggressive in its pursuit of Sunni militiamen, of Sunni resistance figures, and the Al-Qaeda types. And it also began to crush Sunni-dominated neighborhoods. The balance of power really shifted in 2006, and I met resistance leaders, Sunni resistance leaders, in Baghdad and Anbar, Syria, Jordan, and they all said the same thing. We lost. It was a huge shift in how they thought of themselves. They had once thought that they could easily overthrow the Americans and overthrow the Shias. They looked down on the Shias as somehow being inferior to them. In 2006, they realized that they had been defeated, not by the Americans, but by Black and Decker. It was the power drills. If you found a corpse and had its head cut off, it was killed by a Sunni militia. If you found a corpse with the marks of power drills in it, you knew it was killed by Shia militiamen. That was just their signature. And you had this brutal Shia counterinsurgency campaign. Shia militiamen in collaboration with Shia-dominated police and army, which just crushed Sunni neighborhoods and the Sunni population and beat them until they finally realized they had lost. Many were depopulated from Baghdad. Not that Shias didn't suffer. They suffered terribly, perhaps even more. But just numerically, Shias have the superiority, and they had the Americans backing them in this de facto relationship. And the Sunni population was crushed. And that is what finally pushed Sunni resistance groups to ally with the Americans against Al-Qaeda and against the Shia militias. And that was the first huge shift in improving security. And the second big shift was Muqtada Sadr's decision to order his men, the Mahdi army, to freeze, to have a ceasefire. And you saw, and this was in the summer of 2007. That's about eight months maybe after the surge began. In addition to that, the surge, which began in January 2007, this introduction of 30,000 new troops, didn't reduce violence. I was just in Iraq about a month ago. I visited Diyala province, where I saw villages. There are hundreds of villages in Diyala that in the summer of 2007, six, seven, 8 months after the surge began, were totally destroyed by Al-Qaeda and various militia warfare. All the houses were blown up. One day, Al-Qaeda would show up, they'd attack with mortars, they'd slaughter many of the men, and then they'd blow up all the houses. It looks like Bosnia. And that was seven, 8 months into the surge. The real shift, though, was when the Mahdi army declared a ceasefire, and then you saw a huge drop in violence. Now, the American role was important eventually in sort of holding these gains. But the key factors was the Shia victory in the civil war, the crushing of a Sunni population in this brutal counterinsurgency, which the Americans, brutal as they were never going to be that brutal and just slaughter civilians en masse. And the separation of Iraq's groups. You no longer had really mixed areas. The Iraq's social fabric is destroyed, perhaps forever. Sunnis and Shias were separated. The Americans came in with 30,000 new troops, focusing on Baghdad, surrounding neighborhoods with these vast concrete walls. It was very oppressive. It destroyed the social fabric even more, destroyed local markets. It made life very difficult. But it actually helped in the sense that now there was only one entry point and one exit point. So the Americans and the Iraqi forces collaborating with them could determine who belonged and who didn't belong. They could prevent weapons from being smuggled into each neighborhood. They could prevent militiamen from going into the neighborhood. And they were basing themselves in these neighborhoods, which allowed them to, A, improve services. In many cases, Sunni areas weren't getting any electricity or anything. B, develop sources so they could better go after militias. So the Americans did play a role, but it was primarily Iraqi social and political dynamics. And finally, there was the evolution of Prime Minister Maliki, which is key to understand. He came into power with the blessing and support of the Sudrists. But as he matured as a leader and actually began to take his position as Prime Minister more seriously, he realized that the Mahdi army and the Shia militiamen were a competition for power and were undermining his control over the state. So in a surprise move in 2008, he went to war with the Mahdi army. Even the Americans didn't know about it, actually. They were caught by surprise and had to quickly catch up. He called it Charge of the Knights. The Americans ended up rescuing his forces, who were suffering setbacks in their battle against the Mahdi army. But the Mahdi army was subsequently destroyed, and it was Maliki, not the Americans, who was credited by the Iraqis, Sunnis and Shias alike, with destroying the Mahdi army and with this improvement in security. So you finally had a government which had a certain amount of legitimacy as well, thanks to their precipitous drop in violence. Now, it's an improvement only by the horrible standard of 2006 and 2007, when you had a brutal civil war with thousands of people being killed every month. So you have the Iraq of today. I was there a month ago. Every day there are bombings and assassinations with silenced pistols. You're sitting in traffic. Someone can walk by with a magnetic sticky bomb, put it in your car. It blows up. Nobody knows why. It might be an Al-Qaeda thing. It might be political parties fighting with each other. It might be mafias. A director general of a hospital is killed. Was she killed because of that position? Is it Al-Qaeda trying to undermine the system? Or was she killed because of some sexual affair or because maybe her deputy wanted her job and he hired a militia to kill her, which happens a lot. I think that's a true story, actually. It's a constant, but normal pace of violence.
Nir Rosen, we're going to come back to this discussion. And then after that, on this eve of Veterans Day, we'll talk about PTSD. Nir Rosen has written the book Aftermath, Following the Bloodshed of America's Wars in the Muslim World. Back in a minute.
صدري من الأسى كربلا فجراح الحسين بعض جراح وبصدري من الأسى كربلا مرحبا يا عراق كيف العباء وكيف المها وكيف الظباء مرحبا يا عراق هل نسبني بعد طول السنين سمرا أكل الحب من حشاشة قلبي.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadous. Our guest is Nir Rosen. His book is just out. It's called Aftermath, Following the Bloodshed of America's Wars in the Muslim World. As we turn now to another comment by President Bush, President Bush's memoir is just out. And he talked with Matt Lauer of NBC about that period of heightened sectarian violence in Iraq in 2006 as being the worst time of his presidency.
It was the worst time of my presidency, period. And the reason why is because I thought we were about to lose in Iraq.
So in terms of decision points, how hard a decision was the surge for you? Where does it rank?
Well, it was a very difficult decision.
But the surge did succeed in reducing, if not eliminating, sectarian violence.
Have you been given enough credit, sir, for the success of the surge?
I don't seek it. And
do you think you deserve it?
I think it's an interesting decision that when people analyze it, will say, well, it's an interesting decision he made. The verdict is still out.
So that's President Bush talking about the surge with Matt Lauer. And, of course, General Petraeus is the one who headed up that surge in Iraq. He's now the head commander of NATO and U.S. forces in Afghanistan. President Obama has an effect on his own surge in Afghanistan, sending in 30,000 additional troops. What's your take on what's happening there?
As we see, 2010 is the worst year on record, and violence is getting worse and worse. The Taliban control maybe 80% of the country, and they're spreading in the north, and they're spreading in non-Pushtun groups, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Turkmen, so it's not working. Now, the surge didn't work in Iraq. As I said, it was primarily Sunni and Shia developments, Iraqi developments. But even if the surge worked in Iraq, none of the factors which existed in Iraq exist in Afghanistan. So in Iraq, you had Sunni militias realizing they had lost and that they were being defeated and that there was a potential Rwanda of Sunnis that could have happened. And they pushed them to ally with the Americans. The Sunnis in Iraq are 20% of the population, a minority. In Afghanistan, the Taliban are dominated by Pashtuns. It's not a Pashtun movement, but it's dominated by Pashtuns who are maybe 40% of the population, the largest group. And the Taliban feel like they're winning. The Pashtuns have not been punished at all. Maybe if you were the Russians or the Israelis, you could really massively bombard Pashtun areas and defeat them if you were genocidal. The only successful counterinsurgency in history, really, is Malaya, where the British took 500,000 ethnic Chinese Malayans, moved them from their homes, and put them in concentration camps. And that sort of worked. So if you were insanely brutal, you could do that to the Taliban, just move all the Pashtuns. Short of that, you don't really have any sign that that's going to work. In addition to that, Prime Minister Maliki developed some kind of legitimacy. A key principle of counterinsurgency is that you want to build the capacity of the government, strengthen it, and spread it throughout the country so it can take over. In Afghanistan, that's the last thing you want to do. The government is predatory, it's corrupt. It's not a beast you want to feed, it's a beast you want to starve.
This is key strategy. He literally wrote the book on counterinsurgency.
Well, he signed his name at the bottom of it. It was really written by hundreds of other guys, all kinds of experts, and maybe he, you know, dotted a few T's and crossed a few I's. But yeah, he's credited with writing the book, certainly. Although these days in Kandahar, we don't even see them engaged in counterinsurgency. It's just a massive kind of military sweep. Now, in Iraq, they called it population-centric counterinsurgency. The theory is you're going to protect the population. But in Iraq, during the surge, the Americans killed at least three times as many civilians as they did before the surge, with airstrikes, with kill and capture operations, with terrain denial, using artillery in populated areas sometimes. So the population did not feel protected. Likewise, in Afghanistan, we see civilian casualties continue to be going up. And we're fighting a local movement. We're fighting the Taliban. Al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda is in Pakistan. It's in Yemen. It's in internet cafes and slums around the world. So it makes no sense that we have this massive military footprint in Afghanistan where Al-Qaeda isn't, as opposed to Pakistan or Yemen or elsewhere where they are. Not that we should invade Pakistan or Yemen, obviously, but even by our own military logic, what the hell are we doing in Afghanistan fighting a local indigenous movement, which is maybe not loved by many people, but is the only grassroots movement with any legitimacy in much of the country, and is spreading. And we're backing a regime which is hated, illegitimate, lacking credibility, oppressing people. The police, when they're not doing drugs, are ripping people off at checkpoints, are stealing from people, are switching sides to the Taliban. We talk about reconciliation, trying to get the Taliban on our side. So there was a reconciliation last week in Ghazni province. I think you had the police switching sides to the Taliban. And we're setting up militias now, creating new militias, which historically has been a terrible problem in Afghanistan. There's no sign of progress.
You spent time with the Taliban in Afghanistan. You write about that in the book.
Yeah, some of it was against my will.
Well, explain what happened.
What I found, the Taliban that I met, and in general, these seem to be accounts of other people who've met them, are very local. Farmers, villagers, people from the villages where you're meeting them. And they're fighting for very local reasons, not for Al-Qaeda, not for jihad against the Jews and Christians around the world or any kind of battle until Judgment Day. They're fighting for Afghanistan, for Islam, for revenge, because maybe somebody from that village was killed. They're fighting for local grievances. Perhaps one tribe or one clan is being backed by the Americans in a rivalry with another clan, but they're primarily locals with local leadership. Now, what we are seeing, though, in a shift, Petraeus has had some success in his kill and capture operations targeting mid-level commanders. What that's doing, though, is actually having perhaps a negative effect. These older, more experienced commanders were part of the community, had a relationship with the community could pressure them. Likewise, they dated back to the days of Mullah Omar, and they were responding to a real sort of chain of command. These guys are being killed or arrested, a younger generation has taken over, a generation with less ties to the community. They're beginning to kill or alienate traditional elders and leaders. They're much more radical. And they're also less likely to obey commands of Mullah Omar and the old Taliban leadership. So you're going to have an even harder time trying to negotiate with these people. And you're actually, you are pushing them into the hands of al-Qaeda. It's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. The Taliban are not al-Qaeda. It's insane. The Taliban have their own hierarchy. It's Afghans in the senior levels, al-Qaeda, to the extent that they even exist as any kind of movement, has Arabs at the top, not Afghans, or maybe some Pakistanis. They're two separate movements. But by killing more and more of the traditional Taliban leadership, we are going to push them eventually into the hands of al-Qaeda.
AP has reported scribbled notes from Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar have surfaced in mosques all over Afghanistan's ethnic Pashtun heartland, threatening death to anyone who takes up a government offer to negotiate for peace, according to a longtime Taliban member. Your response, Nir Rosen?
It's certainly plausible. I mean, in Afghanistan, you never know what's true and what isn't, thanks to the war. I think the Taliban would like to negotiate. I think Petraeus has sort of nixed any possibility of negotiation. He really takes this war very seriously. He's increased the offensive and increased killing capture operations, going against the own doctrine that he's associated with from Iraq, whether it's true or false. It doesn't matter. But it seems as if they've abandoned counterinsurgency now and are just pushing massively in these clear sweep operations, arresting large numbers of men. I think the Taliban would like to negotiate, but they're going to negotiate from a position of power. And I think the Americans would like to somehow weaken the Taliban momentum so that the Americans feel like they're negotiating from a position of power. But the Taliban are there to stay, and our attention span is going to be limited, a year, 5 years. People talk about 2011 or 2014. We're not going to stay indefinitely. And why are we even there? We've been investing so much money in this country, and what's the return for it? To fight the Taliban? The Taliban are going to attack the U.S. with pickup trucks and AK-47s? It just doesn't seem likely. And if the Taliban take over and al-Qaeda wants to return and set up training bases, even better. You can find them and you can blow them up, as opposed to Pakistan, where there's much better infrastructure, much more dense urban areas. It's easier for them to integrate. One thing that we're doing, actually, we're pushing Afghanistan's problems into Pakistan, which seems like a terrible idea. So you have insurgents who are pushing, who are fleeing into Pakistan, drug networks. And the Taliban, al-Qaeda, that used to be at the border area, now are fleeing, thanks to the drone strikes, into Karachi, into Sindh and Punjab. So we're further destabilizing Pakistan, and that's where the real threat might be.
Nir, we have to go, but I wanted to ask you a last question. You write about in the book how you started reporting. You were working here in New York as a bouncer, and you decided to go to Iraq, and you've been one of the premier independent journalists unembedded in Iraq, Afghanistan, Lebanon, across the Middle East. Why did you decide to become a journalist? And you end the book with a punchy critique of the U.S. media. Your assessment as well of that?
I was a bouncer in Washington, yeah, but that wasn't like it was a career with a lot of promise. It was just something temporary. My aspiration had been to be a journalist for quite a long time, and I was increasingly frustrated with the reporting of the buildup to the war in Iraq, where it seemed obvious to me and to friends who were academics and students who knew the region that it was just impossible that there were weapons of mass destruction. And we knew that the war was going to go horribly wrong. We could see that the media was very much parroting the American line and was very subservient to the American establishment. And I felt very passionate about it. I had some basic knowledge of the language. I had missed my opportunity in Afghanistan, but I knew Iraq would be my opportunity. And indeed, that proved to be the case. I remain deeply emotionally involved in the country. Friends I've made there in 2003 are the ones who helped me now. Although every time I go back, I have to erase a few names from my cell phone because they've been killed. And that happened just this last trip a few weeks ago. But I also remain frustrated with the American media, at least the establishment, with a few exceptions. You have some very brave and independent journalists. But too often, they seem to return to being the handmaids of power, instead of challenging power, instead of having this adversarial relationship with people in power, realizing that people in power lie. I think that's been the fundamental principle guiding my work. So anybody in power is going to lie to maintain their power. It should be obvious, whether they're a leader of a militia in Baghdad or whether they're the leader of the free world. And our job is to undermine that power and undermine those lies.
We want to thank you, Vannir Rosen, for your work and for this latest book, Aftermath, Following the Bloodshed of America's Wars in the Muslim World. He's a fellow at NYU Center on Law and Security. This is Democracy Now! When we come back from break, we'll be joined by filmmakers John Alpert and Matt O'Neill, talking about their latest film, War Torn. It'll air on Veterans Day on Thursday. It's about post-traumatic stress. Stay with us. Military Madness by Woods, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadous.
Well, tomorrow, November 11th, is Veterans Day, the day that honors soldiers who have served in war. While the methods and technologies of war have changed over the years, over the decades, the effects of war on military veterans has stayed the same. What's known as post-traumatic stress disorder has been called many other names throughout the years. During the Civil War in the 1860s, it was called insanity or melancholia. During World War I, it was shell shock. And in World War II, it was combat fatigue. Whatever its name, the effects of war on military veterans can be devastating. An Army report found that in 2009, 160 soldiers committed suicide. Another 146 died by other violent means, such as murder, drug abuse, or reckless driving while drunk. Another 1,700 attempted suicide. Well, a new documentary about post-traumatic stress disorder is airing tomorrow on HBO. It's called War Torn, 1861-2010. And it chronicles the lingering effects of war on military veterans throughout American history, from the Civil War through today's conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Particularly the disturbing feeling, feeling someone's heart beating from inside their body. I still wake up with horrible nightmares from that, sometimes crying and scrubbing my hands, trying to get blood that's not there off.
I don't want to talk. I don't want to eat. I don't want to sleep. I don't want to move. I just want to sit in a corner and just be a vegetable.
When I came back, it was paranoia. A lot of paranoia, emotional detachment. My spouse and I, have basically grown apart.
Some things you just don't want to remember. He block them out. And I've been blocking it for so long.
I couldn't pinpoint a direct day where I'd be like, oh yeah, that happened and that's what caused it. I couldn't do it. I just know that it's not the same anymore.
Never in a million years did I ever think that I would lose my mind.
That was a clip from the new film War Torn, airing on Thursday, Veterans Day, on HBO. John Alpert is co-director of the film, 15-time Emmy winner and co-founder of our former home, the Downtown Community Television Center. He joins us here in our new studios along with Matt O'Neill, who produced the film with John. And joining us via Democracy Now! Video stream, two parents who are featured in the film. Cheryl Softich joins us from Minnesota. Her son, Noah Pierce, killed himself July 2007 after serving in Iraq. And joining us from North Carolina is Chris Schuerman. His son, Jason, shot himself in 2005 after serving also in Iraq. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! John, let's begin with you. Your choice for this film to focus on post-traumatic stress. Why?
This is part of a series that HBO, led by Sheila Nevins, has been making, telling about the consequences of war. We showed what happened in Baghdad, Iraq, when people get chopped up. But there are also injuries that you can't see. And that's post-traumatic stress. The soldiers are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan by the thousands, disturbed by things that they've seen, things that they've had to do. It gets inside their heads and doesn't leave. And it's a terrible situation that for many years the military swept under the carpet, and now they're just beginning to deal with it.
And what's really fascinating in the film is that you go back to the Civil War and somehow find cases of post-traumatic stress disorder back from 1861. Through World War I, World War II. Talk about, how did you get, first of all, these stories from so long ago?
You know, most of the film is comprised of these strong personal narratives that tell the stories of service members in all these different wars. And a thing that's remarkable is you hear the words and the feelings of a soldier in the Civil War reflected in the words and the feelings of a soldier in Iraq or Afghanistan. And I think the takeaway as we researched all these different stories, was that these behavioral and mental health issues are an inevitable part of combat and an inevitable part of war, not something that we can ignore.
And you speak with two—well, James Gandolfini does some of the interviews in the book, The Star of the Sopranos, in the documentary. And he, in one scene, is speaking to two Army psychiatrists, and one of them seems to say that post-traumatic stress disorder affects every soldier in war.
Yes, there was a Medal of Honor winner. The premiere of this film was at the Pentagon, and there was a panel afterwards. And if people want to see this, if they go to HBO.com, it's a very interesting panel discussion, and it featured a Medal of Honor winner. And he looked at all the generals. He says, okay, some people say it's 10% post-traumatic stress. One of the generals says it's 30%. You know, and I know it's 100%. Anybody who engages in warfare is scarred forever.
Ray Odierno, General Odierno, you interviewed in Iraq, or James did. Talk
right
to him?
Uh-huh.
His son was severely wounded in Iraq, and he himself said he may suffer from it, the general himself.
I think it's important that America has this conversation. The military is finally ready to have this conversation, that when you go to war, you have these consequences. We ignore these consequences for generations. Everybody has somebody in their family came back from World War II, an uncle who behaved strangely, who suffered with post-traumatic stress, but nobody ever talked about it. We're starting to talk about it now, and we have to talk about it.
Well, two of the parents featured in the film are joining us here today. Cheryl Softich is joining us from Minnesota. Her son, Noah Pierce, killed himself in July of 2007. Cheryl, thank you very much for joining us today. Talk about what happened when your son returned from Iraq.
My son returned physically, but mentally, he never returned. He served two tours of duty in Iraq, turning 19 and 21 over there. And he just—my son died from the inside out, which is what post-traumatic stress will do to you left untreated. It festers and grows. And he came home, and about a year and a half after being home, he put a gun to his head, and he pulled the trigger, and he is dead. He couldn't handle the nightmares, and he couldn't do it. He didn't want to live that way for the rest of his life, and he just got ridiculed for having post-traumatic stress disorder because there's such a stigma on it. The American people don't want to really seem to acknowledge that it's no different than losing a limb, a leg, or an arm. It just needs to be treated differently.
Cheryl, describe how he dealt at the end and what you saw the signs were. In the film, you talk about your son feeling like he had gone bad because he had killed people in Iraq.
That's the way he felt. He felt that he killed, and so now it was time for him to be dead because he wasn't brought up to kill people. And I could never get him to understand that what he did was he had a job. It was for the Army, and it was his job. And he didn't kill like he thought he did. Everybody's shot. It doesn't mean Noah necessarily killed anybody, but he did kill a few people, as happens in war, and it ate him up from the inside out. He couldn't deal with it.
It was very graphic, his feeling about himself and the way he killed himself, Cheryl, if you could bring yourself to talk about that.
He went to a childhood spot that he had always went to hang out when he skipped school or when he was rabbit hunting or whatever, and he stabbed each and every one of his IDs through the face with a pocket knife. He put his fist through the side window on his truck so he wouldn't have to look at his face. He put his dog tag to his temple. He wedged the gun to that dog tag, and he pulled the trigger. It was his way of saying that I am dead because of my tours in Iraq. The Army killed me. It was his way of letting me know why he did it. It had nothing to do with us.
You've kept the gun. You've kept the truck he killed himself in. You even asked the police for the dog tag that he shot through his temple into his head.
Originally, well, I didn't know about the dog tags until months after the fact. The cops never told me that part of it. When I found out about the dog tag, yes, I wanted it back to go with its mate. As far as the gun, I wanted that gun destroyed. And a year later, that gun was still not destroyed, so I got angry. And I told them, if it's not destroyed, then I want it back. And yes, I do have the gun. I don't know why I have the gun, but I do have the gun. I have the truck. I have the dog tag. It hangs, seriously, it hangs by my bed.
And he wrote you a note as well, is that right?
Yes, he did. First thing in the note, he says he's been in hell since the invasion in 2002. And the last few months of his life, he went out of his way to make sure that he kept myself and my daughter and my husband away from him. He didn't want us to see how bad he was suffering, even though he tried to keep Mom away. It didn't work. Mom showed up every day. I usually left him in tears because he was mean to me, verbally mean, not physically. Verbally mean just to keep me at a distance. It didn't work. I always went back for more. I knew that he was suffering, and he needed to know I was on his side. So I went back time and time again.
We're also joined by Chris Scheuermann. His son, Jason, shot himself in 2005 after serving in Iraq. Both are featured in John and Matt's film that'll air on HBO called War Torn. Chris, one of your sons served in Afghanistan. Jason served in Iraq in 2005. Describe what happened to him. Describe your last experiences with Jason.
It's my opinion that Jason suffered from a traumatic brain injury secondary to an improvised explosive fire. After suffering that injury, he fell into bouts of depression, and he also became suicidal. He wrote a suicide note to his mother in early July, and we notified the Army and told the Army all of this was going on. They basically disregarded that warning. Signs of severe depression or PTSD, and took it for him disobeying. They took minor incidences like being out of uniform, and they would punish him severely for that. And that took a great toll on my son.
he sought help in Iraq.
While Jason was in Iraq, he was sent on a command-directed psychological examination. The Department of Defense requires that those examinations be conducted by a doctoral-level provider. Jason was seen by an individual who held no credentials, no training, and no license. Gave him a standardized test and a 10-minute conversation, and sent him back to his unit with a diagnosis of malingering.
And well, describe the last conversation you had with Jason on the phone.
The last time I talked to my son was when he had just seen the individual who was supposed to help him. He described to me what had happened. I told him that there was no way anyone could come up with any sort of diagnosis based on a standardized test and a 10-minute conversation. I implored my son to go back and get a second opinion. At this point, Jason had been failed by his leadership. He had been failed by the chaplaincy. And now he had been failed by the medical community. All three pillars of foundation that a soldier has settled on had failed him. I believe my son felt absolutely alone. And he told me he could not go back for a second opinion, that they said he was faking it and he just needed to man up.
And you have not received a condolence letter from President Obama, is that correct?
It has been a policy dating back to the Clinton administration that if a soldier dies in theater secondary to a mental disorder and take their own life, the family does not receive a letter of condolence.
Do you want one?
No. Yes, I want one. I want my son's sacrifice recognized. My son was a patriot. He was sick. He was subjected to egregious malpractice. He was abused by his leadership and eventually forced into the closet of his barracks room where he shot himself.
After he came back from seeing seeking help and they told him no, he was told to go to his room and no one else was to be near him. Is that right, Chris Sherman?
A couple weeks after he was sent back to his unit, they had been subjecting him to sleep deprivation. They would wake him up in the middle of the night, tell him to put on his battle gear and run up and down the stairs. They cut off all of his communication with his family. Basically cut him off from all his support structure. They charged him again with being out of uniform. And during those proceedings, his first sergeant told him that if he didn't get his stuff together, that if he was trying to get out of the Army based on a mental issue, that he would be sent to prison and abused in prison. After that encounter, they brought him back to his barracks, sent him to his room with his weapon and his ammunition, and told everyone to stay away from him.
And that's when he killed himself?
Yes.
Cheryl.
He was all alone.
Cheryl. As we wrap up, do you feel your son would be alive today if he had gotten counseling?
I know he would be alive today if he had gotten counseling. He tried to get counseling, but he slipped through every crack there was to slip through, and he finally gave up, but he did try. Had they counseled him before he went to his second tour, he would probably still be alive.
And John and Matt, very briefly, we have to wrap, but you document PTSD from Civil War through today. Is the treatment getting any better?
They've just come up with the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress in the last 30 years, even though we know in the documentary shows that it's been the handmaiden of warfare ever since the beginning of time. If you have war, you have post-traumatic stress, and we have to think about that before we send our men and women into warfare.
We have to end it there. We want to thank you all for being with us. The HBO documentary airs on Veterans Day. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdo-Qudus. Thanks for joining us.